It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn about how to use fresh vegetables to round out one-dish meals on this week's Food Friday.
First, President Trump has embarked on his first international diplomatic trip as commander-in-chief. He'll be visiting Saudi Arabia first, followed by Israel, Belgium, and Italy, and he'll also meet the Pope at the Vatican.
These first foreign trips take on a fair amount of significance for a new president. In President Trump's case, it may be overshadowed by recent scandals sparked by the firing of FBI Director James Comey.
Lily Gorin joins us now. She is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of Women and the White House and Mad Men in Politics. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on today. It's great to be here.
Well, Lily, President Trump has been billed so far on this trip as a reluctant traveler. Why is he seen as less than enthusiastic about traveling, especially in this trip?
Well, I mean, if you followed the campaign, it was very interesting. Mr. Trump doesn't like to sleep any place other than his home. And there were only about three nights in the entire presidential and primary campaign when he didn't go back to New York for the evening. And so, you know, he's sort of not crazy about the idea of apparently sleeping someplace other than his house. And he's also, you know, a little concerned about the length of this trip. He'd asked for it to be shortened, but it's involving the first two country stops in Saudi Arabia and Israel, and then these larger meetings that involve NATO and the G7. And to some degree, none of the participants in these meetings have a lot of control over, you know, how long they are. So he couldn't sort of move them. But this is the trip he's going on. And so we'll see what happens.
And these trips, they can be seen as potential landmines by presidential handlers. What kinds of things can go wrong on a big international trip?
Well, you know, there are any things from like things that happen to all of us, like you might get food poisoning or something. It's obviously we know happened to George H.W. Bush when he was in Japan on a trip. To, you know, sort of small flubs like that. But there's also the issue, and this is, I think, where some of the folks who are working in the White House are most concerned, of the president going, quote, off script. And, you know, you're dealing with a lot of heads of state. You have, you know, sort of cultural awareness to sort of integrate into being in different countries and, you know, sort of operating within their cultural norms. And then there's always, you know, Mr. Trump likes to tweet. He likes to say things that may be not what his staff were hoping he would say. And so there's some of those dynamics at play here.
And so to try to circumvent all of those things which could happen, typically it sounds like a lot of preparation is put into this kind of trip. What do we know about what President Trump himself has undergone to get ready for this big 9-day trip?
Well, from, you know, what I've read about reports about the preparations for the trip, there have been briefings and discussions and, you know, sort of prep with regard to diplomatic issues and particular topics that are going to come up in places like Saudi Arabia or Israel. But Mr. Trump has also been paying a lot of attention to some of the domestic issues that he's sort of been enveloped by in the last 2 weeks with regard to the firing of the FBI director and the appointment of Robert Mueller as the sort of investigator. And Trump has been paying a lot of attention to this. And so what I understand is that it's been more difficult to make sure that he's sort of completely involved in the briefings and, you know, getting all the information he needs before he goes on a big diplomatic trip.
We're talking with Lily Gorin right now from Carroll College, talking about President Trump's first big international trip as commander-in-chief. And Lily, you mentioned that there has been some drama back here at home. There's controversy that is very far from being resolved. Do you expect this to overshadow the trip?
I don't know if it will overshadow the trip per se. And that, you know, is also a function of what's going to be in the news domestically. I understand that Mr. Comey may be testifying before Congress next week. And so if he does, and there are headlines that are generated by that, it's obviously going to be, you know, something that we in the United States will be paying attention to. And it's sometimes more difficult for the, you know, sort of the emphasis of the international trip than to compete with domestic narratives. Other presidents have obviously gone abroad when they were embroiled in a variety of scandals. Both Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton were abroad in the middle and sort of very high points in the various scandals that they were involved in. And this is not necessarily, quote, a high point. This is a sort of churning scandal, as you will.
Well, I suppose it could also be a boon to the Trump White House. There could be interesting, positive headlines that have nothing to do with what's happening, you know, here in the United States.
Absolutely. And that's, I think, a lot of what the anticipation and hope is, that Mr. Trump will go to these countries. He's going to give a big speech about Islam in Saudi Arabia. He's going to go to Israel and go to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial. The anticipation is that, you know, having a president on an international trip will present other headlines that have to do with the United States and diplomacy and engagement with our allies, and that the hope is that those headlines and that news will overshadow some of the sort of scandal that we're sort of experiencing right now at home.
And the president, as you said, he's starting off in Saudi Arabia. You said he's expected to give a big speech about Islam. Do you know what he's expected to say, what the overarching message is expected to be?
I don't know. And it's being written by Stephen Miller, who's not necessarily been a big supporter of Islam. And so that there is some concern with regard to, you know, what the trajectory of that speech is going to be. But it's also supposed to be a kind of response, if you will, to President Obama's speech in Cairo when he went there early in his presidency to talk about the United States relationship with the Arab world. And so this may be, again, President Trump talking about, sort of the United States in relation to our allies. Saudi Arabia is one of our biggest allies in the Middle East. They're also incredibly wealthy, and a lot of their money comes from petroleum. And so that may be part of the discussion with regard to energy and natural resources as well.
Now, Saudi Arabia had not been a huge fan of President Obama's foreign policy in several regards. Do we know about whether Saudi Arabia is looking to sort of hit the reset button with President Trump and start anew?
That seems to be what I understand they are hoping to do, and that, you know, that the royal family in Saudi Arabia would like to do business with the United States, as it were. We, as the United States, sell a lot of military equipment of various kinds to Saudi Arabia. We have for a very long time. They are a military ally of ours there, and their position as a, you know, substantial petroleum exporter, not just to the United States, but to a lot of our allies, is also an important component with regard to our relationship to Saudi Arabia. They've also invited a lot of leaders from other Middle Eastern countries to come there while President Trump is there, and to, you know, to sort of listen to and be part of the speech that he's going to give in Saudi Arabia.
Now, as you said, he's going to be visiting Israel just about a week after it was revealed that he has shared sensitive, classified, likely intelligence from Israeli intelligence agents. And I'm wondering how you think that could affect the conversations that he has with U.S. allies on this trip.
Well, I think that the Israelis hope to have a good visit with President Trump. Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister in Israel, is more enthusiastic about President Trump than he was about President Obama. And I think that the Israeli government, and to some degree the Trump entourage, are hoping to sort of not pay a lot of attention to the, you know, sort of the issue around the revealed classified data, and to some degree continue to have a really robust relationship with Israel, particularly with regard to sharing intelligence.
Does he have any mending offenses to do there, do you think?
Well, it, you know, it may be sort of a personal one-on-one with Netanyahu, that the two of them will sort of sit down and chat about some of this stuff. You know, there is this discussion that Trump had talked about on the campaign trail, and that has come up a little bit with regard to moving the United States embassy to Jerusalem, which is somewhat controversial. And this may be an opportunity for the Israelis to press the Trump administration to move forward on that, because he's sort of backed off of that recently. And so it's, you know, it may be the two heads of state, as it were, sort of having a conversation, more or less the two of them, to see what kind of deals they make.
Lily Gorin is with us right now. She's a professor of political science and global affairs at Carroll University in Waukesha. And she's with us today to talk about President Trump's first foreign trip.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you hope the president accomplishes on this trip? How do you expect the meetings to go with these leaders in other countries? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with political science professor Lily Gorin, talking about President Trump's first international trip since taking office. Lily is with Carroll University in Waukesha.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think will come from the president's trip abroad? What do you hope he accomplishes on this first international journey? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Lily, while he's in Brussels, President Trump is expected to attend a NATO summit with other leaders. And as you know, the president has been pretty critical, had some tough words for NATO, particularly on the campaign trail. So how do you think that dynamic could end up playing out on this trip?
Well, I mean, this may be an opportunity for some of the other NATO leaders to talk to President Trump about, you know, what he really intends with regard to the United States involvement in NATO. And does he have a fully fleshed out opinion of what needs to change, what NATO can do better, or what NATO shouldn't be doing, you know, what might be some of the issues that the leaders themselves can come together about. You know, NATO was created during the Cold War as, you know, as sort of an alliance across the Atlantic to battle the Soviets. And there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, NATO is still at a useful alliance, but its mission has changed because the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. And so it may be an opportunity for President Trump and a lot of the other NATO leaders to sort of talk about recalibrations with regard to what NATO's mission is. And I guess, you know, they can press him on whether or not the United States will remain in NATO.
You know, conversations like that, they may be difficult. In a trip like this, we were talking earlier about how choreographed they tend to be for good reason. And the president is known for shooting from the hip. So do you imagine there to be some a disconnect there in his communication style versus some of these highly charged situations that he may find himself in?
I mean, it remains to be seen. And this is definitely his first foreign trip as president. You know, he did go to Scotland when he was a candidate to open one of his golf courses there. And most other sort of new presidents have usually gone to either Mexico or Canada as their first trip to kind of, you know, get their feet wet and, you know, to go through a lot of the sort of diplomatic processes. But Trump decided to, you know, sort of wrap this big trip with the G7 and with NATO and with these stops in the sort of these religious centers for Judaism and Islam and for Catholicism all together. And so, you know, he's looking to probably make a, quote, big splash, as is the inclination of President Trump, from what I've seen of him, not only as a political person, but also, you know, otherwise. And so it may be that, you know, the other leaders also are going to have to sort of get used to dealing with President Trump, who's different from certainly George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or Barack Obama.
Now, you mentioned that he's visiting holy sites, several of them on this trip. He's also going to be meeting in person with the Pope. Can you tell us about some of those sites that he's expected to visit and what the takeaway might be for him?
Well, he's going to, you know, he's going to be going to the Vatican and having a meeting with the Pope. And it's not clear that the Pope is one of his biggest supporters. So that may be also interesting. He is going to briefly visit Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Memorial in Israel. And I believe he's also going to go to the Western Wall, which was part of the Old Temple in Jerusalem. And most presidents who visit the Western Wall don't do it with other politicians in Israel. They do it as a kind of personal journey. And then he is going to be giving this presentation in Saudi Arabia, which is also the, you know, sort of the focal point for many Muslims who do the pilgrimage there to Mecca.
So let's talk about that last, that he'll be giving a presentation. What might be expected from him, given comments that he's made that have been critical, and also considering that his tenure as president started out with the so-called Muslim ban, banning temporarily people from entering the country from so-called Muslim-majority nations? What would the dynamics of that be?
Well, you know, again, he's going to the Middle East, and he's going to one of the centers of Islam, and he will be giving a speech on Islam. But again, until I hear it, I don't exactly know what the thrust of that speech is going to be. But it's also, you know, an opportunity for Trump to kind of lay out what he sees as the relationship between the United States in particular, and possibly the West more broadly, and Islam and many of these Arab countries that majority Muslim countries that have been our allies. I mean, again, Saudi Arabia, long-standing ally of the United States, and you know, to some degree, how he sees that relationship continuing, even though he has been an advocate for banning Muslims from coming to the United States, because as he sees it and has articulated it, the threat from radical Islam.
Now, if this trip goes exceedingly well and the meetings go well, the visits to the holy sites go well, how will we know? What would success look like?
Success would probably look like positive discussions of his interactions with a lot of the other leaders of countries, and again, probably following a more closely following a script more closely than Trump tends to. And that's, you know, that as you noted earlier, he tends to fire more off the cuff. And if he's, you know, if he's in these situations where, you know, you can sort of say the wrong thing or ask the wrong question, and that becomes the story, as opposed to, you know, here we are reengaging with our allies in Saudi Arabia and Israel and NATO, and, you know, having tough conversations, but doing it in a, you know, collaborative way. If that's the narrative, then that is probably going to be a successful trip. If the narrative is, you know, did Trump insult somebody, or did he insult a religion, or, you know, did he ask for the wrong kind of food or something, then that, you know, overshadows any of those possibly positive diplomatic engagements.
And he will be the spokesperson in chief also for his America First policy, which is likely to raise a lot of questions as he travels throughout Europe. Do you have any idea what he might expect as he goes on this trip with that policy and what it might mean for the rest of the world in mind?
I have a feeling that's a lot of the questions that he will be receiving from leaders of the G7 countries, which are, you know, advanced industrialized democracies, and they will want to know, what does it mean if you're articulating America First for alliances like the G7 or for NATO? And so they may, you know, they may take those questions directly to him and ask him to explain how those things work together. How does America First work with alliances that have been in place for quite some time?
So as the trip goes forward, it's just begun today. Lily, what in specific are you looking for? What kind of earmarks to see how it's going and where the flashpoints might be?
Well, you know, again, he's got a lot of his communication staff with him. In fact, he's a lot of staff with him. And so when Trump arrives in a lot of these places, you have the normal kind of, you know, fanfare and experiences. And a lot of that's going to be the photos that we'll see on the internet and on newspapers. But then what does the accompanying story written by reporters who are also, you know, either writing in the countries that or following, you know, going with the president as members of the United States media. What are the stories they're reporting? What is the sort of explanation for what he's doing and how he's doing it and what he says? And so it's both the telegraphing of these images of Trump with various world leaders, but also, you know, what is the discussion that they're having and what's reported, what happens at press conferences. And again, if there are people around them who are sort of leaking to the media, what are they saying?
Now, he's had a contentious relationship, Lily, with the press, the media in the United States. What do you think he's likely to face from the press corps in different countries as we wrap up?
I mean, that will definitely be one of the things I'm curious to see, because they, you know, they haven't been following him on the day-to-day level exactly the way the U.S. media has, but they certainly know what's going on and the contentious relationship that he has had with the American media. And so it may be interesting to see what the foreign press in a lot of these countries do, what kind of questions they may have the opportunity to ask, and what they write about the president's visit to their country.
We'll leave it there. Lily, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be on the show again.
That was Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global affairs at Carroll University in Waukesha. She's the author of the books Women in the White House and Mad Men in Politics. She was with us today to talk about President Trump's first foreign trip during his term and his approach to diplomacy.
With farmers markets starting and even some herbs and early vegetables popping up in gardens, it's a great time to think about all the great ingredients coming into season.
But even with a new crop of produce upon us, some things stay the same. That's the crunch that a lot of us feel trying to put together a well-balanced meal that's also tasty.
Luckily, cookbook author Susie Middleton has us covered with her new book called Simple Green Suppers, a fresh strategy for one-dish vegetarian meals. Susie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, I'm so glad to be with you guys today.
Well, we're zeroing in on strategy. So
yeah.
What is this new strategy for one dish vegetarian meals?
Well, it's kind of fun because I converted to being a full-time vegetarian about 3 years ago, and I realized, gosh, you really have to have a plan in place if you're going to come home every night and make a delicious vegetarian supper. And it starts with kind of refreshing your pantry. And I've arranged the book around noodles, grains, beans, leaves, toast, tortillas, eggs, and broth. And those are your main staples that I sort of walk you through how to stock a few basics in all those areas, and then how to make some really quick and easy flavor boosters and bring your fresh vegetables home and combine them together for a really delicious one-dish vegetarian meal.
And this really can happen in one dish, right?
It really can. It doesn't mean only one pot or pan.
Okay, all right.
Because then you would absolutely be, baking everything or, you know, sauteing everything. But, you know, most of the time it's not a lot. But it all comes together in a dish that is well-balanced. It has protein, it has flavor, it has crunch. I use a lot of toasted nuts and things that add flavor, crispy shiitakes, and I give lots of pointers on how to make those things ahead of time so that you can have them stocked up and really sort of layer flavors into a dish pretty quickly. And I also give you a good technique for cooking grains ahead and keeping them in the fridge for a week. And so it really kind of becomes a fun assembly into your one bowl.
Let's talk about those grains, because I love eating grains and there's a lot of them out there, but they take so long to cook. And if I'm hungry and it's 5:30, I don't want to wait 45 minutes to cook a grain. So what do you suggest? What is that technique?
Well, two things. One, I have a great technique, which is basically the pasta cooking method, where you boil grains in, you don't have to do pilaf style, which is sort of a measured amount of water, and it's a little tricky, and you never know if you've got the right amount, and sometimes you finish cooking, they're still chewy. With this, you just throw the grains in the boiling pot of water, and then you taste them to see if they're done. It works especially well with short grain brown rice and wheat berries, and short grain brown rice cooks at about 25 minutes. But all the and quinoa cooks in about 12 minutes that way. You can cook white rice that way. But you can also cook all those grains that with that method, drain them, and then keep them in the fridge for about a week. Then you just throw them into stir fries and sautés. And what I'm suggesting is not the old-fashioned way of eating grains where you've got like a ton of them with just a little bit of vegetables. I'm suggesting kind of you add grains in more like handfuls into your salads and your sautés.
They don't get mushy if you put them in the fridge?
No, no. They really hold up really well, especially things like wheat berries and brown rice and quinoa. And you can put them right into your stir fry pan.
Let's talk about that recipe with the wheat berry salad, the quick roasted beet and arugula and wheat berry salad with strawberry balsamic dressing. It sounds wonderful, and the recipe is up on the Central Time Facebook page. Take us through this.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. It's such a pretty salad, and it's a great great one for this time of year. There are two quick ideas in here in Make-Aheads. One, in fact, is the wheat berries. Wheat berries are one of the longer cooking grains, and so to cut your cooking time, I do suggest soaking those overnight. And then I usually cook my grains on a Sunday afternoon and make sure they're well-drained and keep them in the fridge. Now, beets are a vegetable that usually take a really long time to cook. There's a very quick way to get around that, and that is to slice them thinly, spread them out on a sheet pan and roast them, and they get into these nice little, you take them out before they get really, really crisp, but they're nice and pliable and sweet and caramelized, and that's about 12 to 14 minutes. So to put a salad like this together on a weeknight, you basically get a nice platter or some serving plates. You layer down some arugula, you sprinkle on your roasted beets and some sliced up strawberries, toss on some of your grains if you've already got cooked. And if you don't, substitute something like quinoa that cooks quickly or white rice. And then you make a quick little dressing with some diced up strawberries, some balsamic vinegar, and some maple syrup and drizzle that over all. And that makes actually a vegan salad. And if you want, you can add the fresh goat cheese. If not, you don't have to.
Oh, that sounds delicious. Oh, yeah. That one is up right now on our Central Time Facebook page. And I want to talk some more about what you said about layering flavors in. And it sounds like it's not all happening at the spur of the moment, but you've got a lot of this ready. Can you talk about that idea that you can layer the flavors on?
Well, especially in a one-dish meal and a vegetarian meal, I think sometimes we all think of vegetarian meals as either being kind of boring or heavy, and you always want to have a little bit of freshness and a little bit of crunch. So I sort of give you ideas on how to layer those flavors actually in the bowl so that you're putting on some toasted nuts, you're putting on some fresh herbs at the end, so you're adding some texture and some brightness, and maybe you've got a little tiny lemon herb sauce at the end or cucumber yogurt sauce, or I have about 30 sauces in the book which are easy to make, a little lemon tahini sauce, a blender Caesar dressing. Those things are also great to make ahead because they keep in the fridge for a week, and that gives you another, like a finishing flavor. And so I'm giving you lots of opportunities. I'm also big on salting while you're cooking, which, you can describe that as layering flavor. You want to bring out flavor at every step of your cooking. That's one way, to bring flavor in, and then also the whole layering idea of textures.
We're talking right now with Susie Middleton, and her new cookbook is called Simple Green Suppers, a fresh strategy for one-dish vegetarian meals. And with all the great produce coming up right now, it's so much fun to get some inspiration for what to do with all these veggies. Susie, when you're cooking your grains, do you throw some of your veggies in later on in the cooking at all? Do you ever combine the cooking of your grains and your veggies?
No. Okay. No, because I do think that tends to, I'm not a big boiler of vegetables.
Okay.
I think vegetables are really tasty when they're have a little bit of high heat. So my favorite methods are stir frying, sauteing, roasting, and grilling, because I think that makes vegetables more tasty for people. And also, especially with vegetables like mushrooms and eggplants, it makes them have a deeper flavor, and that gives you some umami flavor that you don't get with meat. And so I don't generally, and again with the grains, I keep it simple so that I can put them in the fridge and then use them throughout the week.
And also
the other thing about this, there is kind of a, I play the strategy out in the book with lots of examples, so that I'm trying to give you the tools so you can use the recipes, and then once you get a sense of how to assemble these things, you can make them on your own, which I'm finding out from people who are cooking from the book. They're really enjoying doing that, sort of making their own dishes up.
You've got a section in your book about cooking with a veggie plus, in this case, it's eggs. You pair up different things. And
right.
this is a great one right now, because probably it's going to be a warm dish. It's a little chilly in Wisconsin right now.
I know.
Can you give us some ideas for pairing up the eggs and veggies?
Well, there's a really fun thing, which is called a puffy pancake, which is really basically just a giant popover. And a lot of people may have heard of Dutch babies or a sweet puffy pancake, but this is a savory one where it's just you whiz up eggs, milk, and flour and put it in a hot saute pan, and it puffs up. And when it comes out of the oven, you fill it with sauteed vegetables. And I have some different ideas. There's a spiced cauliflower. There's a cherry tomato and corn filling, so that's really fun. And I have a couple different really yummy frittatas and a Yukon Gold and Brussels sprouts hash with a fried egg, which is very tasty. So
yeah,
there's
that sounds great.
Lots of different approaches.
Yeah, and the egg also can be pretty versatile for you to hold things together, but also give you that protein.
Exactly. And so I want people not to overlook the fact, I mean, these days it's really fun to like throw a fried egg on it and call it an egg dish. But one of the best things eggs do is provide a binding quality. So making savory pancakes or making baked eggs or making savory bread puddings, which I think are delicious. And we've got Japanese vegetable pancakes in the book, and our savory bread puddings have Brussels sprouts again, cheddar, Dijon, and shallots, and that really makes a hearty meal.
Susie Middleton is with us right now. She's sharing some terrific recipes and ideas from her new cookbook, and it's called Simple Green Suppers, a fresh strategy for one-dish vegetarian meals.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are there particular vegetables that are the superstars of your cooking? Or maybe you have a vegetable that you love, but you need some help in figuring out new ways to prepare it. Susie is happy to help. Call in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation with Susie Middleton about her newest cookbook. This one's called Simple Green Suppers, a fresh strategy for one-dish vegetarian meals.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are there early veggies that you look forward to every year? What are they and how do you prepare them? Are you a master of one-pot meals, or could you use some help? And what do you pair with veggies to round out a meal? Is it eggs? Is it grains, breads, or maybe all of the above? Call in at 800-642-1234 to share your tips or get some help, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Carly on the line in Cumberland. Carly, hello.
Hi there. I was just wondering, From Susie, what her favorite way to prepare eggplant is, because I usually have some trouble grilling it or marinating it.
Great, Carly. Thanks for that. And I love eggplant, so I can't wait to hear your answer, Susie.
Well, you know, part of the success with eggplant is how you cut it. And if you're going to, the skin can be very tough. So one tip is to score it with a fork first, then slice it. And if you want to grill little baby eggplants, cut them in half and score them, cut the flesh, and that helps the heat get into them. And another trick with grilling eggplant is to get it on a hot grill, the slices, oil and salt them, cook them on both sides so that they're golden brown, and then take them off and stack them in tin foil so that they finish steaming through. Because Carly, I don't know what your issue is, but for me, sometimes I find the eggplant is undercooked. And so sometimes wrapping it up and letting it steam off the heat will help that.
Any particular seasoning, Susie, that you think go particularly well with eggplant?
Oh, definitely fresh mint. So when it comes into season, all the Mediterranean spices are good, cumin and coriander, paprika, cinnamon, but I think in the summertime, grilling it and making a little vinaigrette with lemon and fresh mint is a great way to go, and a little bit of garlic.
That sounds wonderful. Carly, thank you so much for your call. Let's go with Mary in Pewaukee. Hi, Mary.
Yes, hi. Good to be on the show for my first time. I this morning just made kind of sautéed in EVOO, extra virgin olive oil, the cauliflower florets the broccoli florets and onion, so those three, and about, you know, your 5 minutes. While meanwhile, in a bowl, I whipped up about four eggs and a little bit of milk, or half and half, or you can use almond milk. It makes it a little bit sweeter. And then I'm making scrambled eggs, and then I took my sautéed vegetables, put that in the bowl, and I put it in the microwave for a couple of minutes. Then when I was really ready to eat it, I kind of just baked it for a little while. You could take it that way to work or wherever, and then just warm it in the microwave. And it was a very good meal, and depending on what spices you use, I used cumin, salt, cardamom, and a little paprika. Hmm. Very good.
Susie, what about those spices and that combination with those vegetables?
Oh, cauliflower is really good with cumin and those spices. That's a delicious. And also eggs take a lot of seasoning. That's one thing people don't realize. It sounds like that you've got figured out. It's salt and pepper and spices and herbs, really, you want to add into your eggs before you cook them.
Well, terrific. Those are good ideas. And let's go to another caller here at 800-642-1234 as we talk to Susie Middleton, the author of Simple Green Suppers, A Fresh Strategy for One-Dish Vegetarian Meals. And Becca is with us now from Elk Mound. Hi, Becca.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a question on some new and interesting ways to cook zucchini and yellow squash. We usually end up sautéing it in extra virgin olive oil and salt and pepper, and I'm just wondering if there's any way I could put a new twist on that.
Oh, good question. What about that one, Susie?
Oh, it's definitely good roasted also, or grilled, and I would slice it on the bias so you get sort of angled pieces, and slice them about a quarter inch thick, because you want the zucchini to have a lot of surface area to get brown, and then toss it with some oil and salt and either put it at 425 on your a covered baking, you know, parchment or aluminum foil covered baking sheet, and really get the bottom side brown, and then flip it, and it'll cook in about 16 minutes, and then you can put a little vinaigrette again of like basil and sun-dried tomatoes on that, and it's delicious. Also, what goes well with roasted zucchini is a little fresh goat cheese, and you can do the same technique, that kind of slice on the grill as well.
Becca, thank you so much for your call. Susie, you also pair vegetables and beans, and I know some people are reluctant to use too many beans, but what do you like about that combination?
Well, I'm freaking out about chickpeas. I use them a lot in the book because I discovered, first of all, I I do find them more digestible than a lot of other beans, if that is a concern for people. But the neat thing is you can saute or roast chickpeas. They have enough structure and they actually brown up, unlike other beans that sort of fall apart when you do that. And they're very high in protein. So I do actually take, you can use canned chickpeas and rinse them and drain them, or you can cook your own, which I have easy instructions for in the book. I think they have a little better texture when you cook them yourself. And again, they keep in the fridge for several days. But then I throw those into stir fries, just like you would do with your chicken or your shrimp if you're eating meat. But instead, if I want to make a quick stir fry on a weeknight, I throw in my cooked chickpeas and brown them up and then put garlic and and herbs in it. It's very delicious.
I had a chickpea recipe at a restaurant at one point. I think they were roasted chickpeas with some rosemary. And so I've been trying to roast chickpeas at home, and they're never as good. I use the canned ones. They're not the fresh ones. But I think I also did crock pot the others, and I can never get them to have the right texture or enough flavor. Do you have any ideas about how to boost that?
Well, definitely be sure you're roasting them long enough, and you kind of have to, I've found you have to go with a medium oven temperature so that they get kind of crisp all the way through, and the roasted chickpeas will not stay crisp too long out of the oven, but toss them with oil and salt before cooking, and then right when they come out, you can toss them in your spice mixture if you want to give them a little flavor.
Oh, that's a good idea. Wait till then. Because, it did seem to kind of disappear by the time they came out of the
oven. Yeah, you can do it afterwards.
Great, thanks.
Yeah.
And in this recipe where you combine the chickpea stir fry with the sugar snaps and the spring onion, and then you've got this cucumber yogurt sauce going through it. Can you toss this together? Toss it together for us.
This sort of, because I love my chickpeas now, out of my garden, because I'm a small farmer also, the sugar snap peas come in, and for us in early June or mid-June, we're not so different from you because we're on an island and it's a little colder out here than the rest of New England. But and then we get our first spring onions, which are just immature bulb onions, but they're quite delicious. And we get our first mint, and so that's a really nice vegetable combination. So I thought, well, I'm going to try it with chickpeas, and it feels like it should have sort of a Mediterranean feel to me. So I put a little cumin and coriander, added a little baby spinach. And then very quickly, if I just want to finish that off, I mix some lime juice, honey, and tamari and just eat it that way. Or if I have a little extra time, I make a very quick cucumber yogurt sauce, which also is pretty versatile. And that has fresh mint and lime juice and Greek yogurt and honey in it.
Those all sound like good options.
Yeah.
And Susie, for the pantry, if we want to be prepped, you said, sometimes it takes a lot of planning to get through a week of meals. What are things that we can have on hand that make this a little bit easier when it comes time to cook?
Well, I give a lot of pep talk about that in the book because choices can be overwhelming. And I think if you narrow down, you have to sort of try some things and see what you like and then decide to stock up on them. For me, I really love short grain brown rice. I like red quinoa and wheat berries. So I keep those in jars. I buy them in bulk because it's a little cheaper. I keep a variety of noodles around. I've started to like the rice flour noodles a little bit more. And I keep good bread in the freezer. I have a whole chapter in the book on toast, which is kind of fun. And so I buy it and slice it and put it in the freezer. Same thing with tortillas. So there's lots of tips on how to kind of refresh your pantry and be ready when it's time to make dinner.
And what would you say to people who think a meal won't be satisfying enough without some meat in it?
Well, that's another thing we're approaching a lot in the book. As I mentioned, like including umami vegetables like eggplant and avocado and mushrooms and caramelizing things so they have more flavor, adding lots of nuts, using dressings that have protein in them like a tahini dressing or a Caesar dressing. I've tried to approach each of the recipes in the book so that they will be satisfying and filling. And surprisingly, one of the most popular recipes now in the book is a butternut squash toast, and it is... it's very filling. It's really, it's quite amazing. So,
Well, Susie, thanks so much for joining us today. The cookbook is Simple Green Suppers, a fresh strategy for one-dish vegetarian meals. That's Susie Middleton's cookbook. And you can find recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. It is well worth noting that today is National Bike to Work Day, and Madison holds the distinction of being one of the best biking cities in North America. And so with the weather turning warmer, and it's nice to see so many bikers out every day, I just love seeing it, and I don't bike to work yet, Veronica, but how about you?
I haven't. I have in the past. I think I would wait till it warms up just a little bit more, and I, you know, the kids' school makes a difference. If I can bike from there versus from farther away, I'm going to take the closer route because I want to get here in a decent amount of time, but my husband loves to bike to work, and he'll go, you know, he'll arrive probably completely drenched, and he'll bike for hours to get here.
There's planning involved, so he must be a good planner, too. Because he has to think about packing his bag and what
there
he needs on the other end. It also takes, you know, time and energy.
This is true. This is true. And we are trying to get our next generation of bikers out there. We're teaching our youngest how to bike. So that's our adventure. That's our project for the summer. So that's kind of my contribution to a future bike to worker.
Excellent. Little steps. Progress. Uh-huh. Little steps.
And little bikes.
And little bikes. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.